Hi there, welcome to the Osler Podcast. My name's Todd Fraser and I'm here with another episode from the 21st Annual ANZIC CTG Conference from Noosa, Australia. And joining me this morning is Ian Seppelt. Ian, as many of you know, is the lead researcher of the Sudoku trial, which is exploring the impact of selective decontamination of the digestive tract on patient outcomes in the ICU. Ian, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure being here.
So this has been a long journey for you, the story of SDD. Where did all of this start for you?
The whole thing started with the publication of a particular trial about 15 years ago in Europe, and then conversations with a number of people, particularly Simon Pfeiffer, about whether this is a trial that is feasible or something that we would want to do. Then in 2010, the clinical trials group was approached by Brian Cuthbertson, who was working in Aberdeen, to participate in a sort of global collaboration looking at SDD. And this started off with some observational work, some opinion and interview-based qualitative research, trying to dissect out exactly why, when there's strong evidence in the literature already, why don't we do SDD? And the conclusions aren't surprising, but it was still very interesting going through the exercise of evaluating the actual barriers to SDD, because it all comes down to bias and opinion and not evidence. And interestingly, the people that hold the biases and opinions aren't necessarily the people that should be doing it. So, for example, people say, oh, it's difficult, it's dirty, nurses don't like doing it. But then talk to nurses in the UK who do STD. They say, well, no, it's actually fine, there's no problems. So it was very interesting being part of that process, just dissecting out why we don't do STD, what do people believe. Predominantly, it's concern about resistance. This is particularly held by some infectious diseases type people. That's not consistent with the evidence. All the published evidence is that there is no greater resistance developing. And in fact, in some places in Europe, SDD is initiated deliberately as part of a strategy to treat problems with resistance. And there's been some recent follow-up publications, one I'm thinking of from a Spanish intensive care unit published in 2018, where they had a major resistance problem. They introduced STD as part of their strategy. 5 years later, they have confirmed there's no significant change in the incidence of either colistin or tobramycin resistance, and overall, their multi-drug resistant gram-negative rates have gone down in that time. So there's no convincing evidence that resistance does increase with the use of STD, but people are scared. And that's certainly what we found in that initial work, just to dissect out why people believed what they believed.
So as you say, this is a therapy that's got a fairly robust data set to support its implementation, but we still don't do it widely. Whereabouts in the world is it practiced with any sort of ubiquity?
So the only places really are in Western Europe, so particularly the Netherlands, and then sporadically in other areas in Europe. So there are 13 ICUs in the UK that say that they do STD. It's all homemade, they all do their own version, so there's very little standardisation. And there are a number of units elsewhere in Europe that do. Sometimes, like the Spanish unit I was describing, as part of a strategy to deal with a problem with resistance, though places like the Netherlands that have very low endemic resistance rates do it most frequently. Outside Western Europe, there is really nowhere. As far as we can tell, there's nowhere in the USA, there's nowhere in North America at all, there's nowhere in Australia or Asia or South Africa that does STD, and we have to ask the questions why.
So the key one that you mentioned, obviously, is fear, which is to some extent completely understandable, yep. isn't it, about the generation of resistance. But as you say, the evidence base doesn't support that. Are there other concerns that people have?
There's some pragmatic things. So there's no commercial preparation, for example. So to do it requires making something, either at the bedside or in the hospital pharmacy. And there's a degree of hassle that goes with that. So many people don't want to do that for something that they don't really want to do anyway. There's also problems with availability of some of the agents. So if every major intensive care unit in the world adopted STD, there'd be a global colistin shortage, for example, because that's actually quite hard to get at the moment. It is very difficult to get amphotericin base, and most people have now switched from amphotericin to nystatin, which is an equivalent drug orally and intrally. It's just too toxic to give nystatin intravenously, but that's not part of the STD protocol.
So if there are areas in the world that do use this, for example, mm-hmm. the Netherlands, how have they overcome the biases and the concerns to be able to make that a common therapy?
So the majority of the trials have either been driven from the Netherlands or conducted in the Netherlands. So there's certainly a lot more exposure and familiarity there. As far as I can tell, and this is a bit difficult to get much information about, most of the agents are made in hospital pharmacies there. Certainly, there's nobody who has ever done a proper commercial preparation of STD products or manufactured something using all the rules of good manufacturing practice and licensing and stability testing. We've had to do that as part of our trial, and that's been a bit of an eye-opener, seeing some of the small problems that develop when you go through that process, which I think have just been either not noticed or ignored in the past with homemade preparations.
So Sudoku is, I hope I'm saying that correctly, yeah. Is a study that is going to hopefully provide more reassurance to people, both on the outcome benefits but also on the ecological impacts
right,
of
yes.
STD. Can you tell us about the study and where it's up to?
Yeah, so this is a cluster randomised controlled trial, which is currently recruiting in Australia, and we're hoping to combine this with sites in Canada and the United Kingdom as well. But currently we have 18 clusters in 16 hospitals in Australia who are all at various points in the first 12-month phase of the RCT. As a crossover trial, what that means is that every hospital, every cluster, spends 12 months as a control unit where patients who fulfil the inclusion criteria are identified and data are collected, but there's no intervention. And they also spend 12 months in an intervention period where all patients who fulfil criteria are given STD as part of usual practice for that ICU for that time. There's a three-month washout between those two periods, and there's also a period of baseline data collection to determine the underlying ecology of the ICU before anything happens, and a final ecology data collection to try and get some information about whether we've changed the ecology of the ICU by doing the study. So units are randomised for the order of the phases. Some are control units first, some are intervention units first. But overall, that's two intervention periods of 12 months each, plus three-month observational periods as well. So it's the whole study there takes 2 years and 9 months.
So there's some centres that are now live using STD as part of the intervention
right, yeah,
arm.
Yeah.
One of the major potential benefits of this trial is to reassure people that the resistance generation issue can be overcome. Can you tell us what that will involve and how confident you are that you'll be able to give those answers definitively?
Yeah. There's not going to be anything definitive, I don't think. The two things that we're doing for resistance, firstly, in the main trial, we're limited by funding and pragmatics, but we're collecting data from the microbiology laboratories in every hospital, just of locally reported isolates, particularly new bloodstream infections, new sterile site infections, and also all reported resistant organisms. And that's just going to be followed over time. So the goal there in the main study is just to look at overall resistance rates at a macro level, and we will have the power to at least say there has not been a significant change before and during and after the study. We're also doing a much more detailed microbiological study in a subset of units in New South Wales, looking particularly at the genomics and the metagenomics of the bacteria that are found in both faeces, rectal swabs and endotracheal swabs. So that requires collecting serial swabs from patients who are recruited into the trial. We're trying to get these specimens as close to recruitment as possible, and then day 1, 3, 5, 7, and then if they're still in the ICU every 7 days. And that will provide information both on the temporal changes in the microbiological load for these patients, but also the emergence of resistance genes in particular. The one everyone is the most scared of in Australia is colistin resistance, and there's some specific colistin resistance genes that can be tested for. So while this will be in a subset of participating ICUs, all in New South Wales, purely for logistic reasons, because this is all being done in John Idle's lab in Westmead, but that will, I hope, provide some reassurance as well.
Do you think it will be enough to convince the general ICU public to adopt this?
The trouble with most of these trials is that the true disbelievers will still disbelieve, the true believers believe already. But I think for the majority of people, that should provide the information needed, yeah.
Philosophically, if it wasn't for this trial, would you be doing this in your intensive care unit?
Probably not. Before we started this process, we weren't, despite the evidence that was out there. And that's due to, I think for most people in Australia, it really hadn't been on the radar. There's no preparation, there's no guidelines saying that you should do it. It's not what people had done historically. So we as humans tend not to change unless there's some overwhelming reason to change. What's going to come out of this study is one of three possible outcomes. And the thing I like about it is that all three are important. The best outcome would be a positive trial if we can confirm there's a mortality benefit from STD and there's no problem with resistance. And I think for Australia at least, but hopefully for all the non-Western European parts of the world, that will be enough to convince them that there actually is benefit in this. And as a public health initiative, you can save a substantial number of lives by doing that. Alternatively, we may show there is no survival benefit at all. And I think if we can't save lives, no one really cares about resistance because it's dead as a concept. The third possible outcome is the hardest one to work out and it's perhaps the most likely. But if we do save lives, but there is a concern about resistance or some signal, it's then a matter of balancing priorities. If for all sick ventilated intensive care patients we do have an improved survival of 2 or 3% absolute reduction in mortality, then you tolerate some degree of resistance as a consequence. And then what is going to be most important is working out some of the kinetics of that. There are, again, European data that while every patient changes their bowel flora and the bowel resistance patterns while in ICU, a lot of that is not sustained. And some weeks after discharge, particularly if they're back onto a normal diet, everything goes back to normal, so maybe that doesn't matter so much. But that's still very much an open question.
And one of the things that is frequently raised about STD and the protocols is the role of intravenous antibiotics as part of the regimen. How will that be dealt with in Sudoku?
Yeah.
And what do you think is the impact of that?
So that's the most controversial part and actually the least important part of the whole protocol, but it's the one that people get very, very worked up about. So the role from the initial Dutch protocols was to give a short course of a broad-spectrum antibiotic with gram-negative activity to deal with organisms that might have been aspirated during intubation. That's the purpose. So in the original protocols, that was 4 days of ceftriaxone or 4 days of ciprofloxacin if there was a problem with allergies, unless the patient is already on a suitable broad-spectrum antibiotic anyway. We did some pilot work prior to Sudoku, just as an observational study in our ICUs, identifying patients who fit the inclusion criteria. And just on two-thirds of those were already on a broad-spectrum antibiotic. So for two-thirds of the patients, they're being treated with something therapeutically because they have pneumonia, because they have whatever brought them into the ICU. So it's only a smallish subset that have additional antibiotics prescribed as part of the STD protocol. Then what's interesting, looking at data from the major Dutch trials, they record the use of all antibiotics, both the protocolised antibiotics and general wild-type antibiotics prescribed by the doctors. And patients who get STD, in fact, have a lower overall exposure to antibiotics. So while they do get more protocolised antibiotics, there's much less prescribing of other things. And if you look at all of that in terms of daily defined doses of antibiotics, the overall DDD is lower in the STD arm. We're collecting the same data and hopefully can demonstrate the same result as part of Sudoku. Having said that, it still gets people very, very excited about, do we need to prescribe extra antibiotics? Aren't we generating an MRSA and other resistance things by doing so? But that's not consistent with the evidence.
Yep. I think this is probably the fourth time that I've interviewed you about STD over the years. Fair to say you've been, at least in Australasia, the public face of this concept for a decade now. Has that been a frustrating process to get this to the face it is now?
No, it's just been very interesting. It has been a slow and incremental process by a whole team. So while I'm sitting here talking to you, but it's actually been the team at the George Institute that has been driving this study, and I have to fully credit the professional study managers there who actually do all the hard work. I get to sit here and talk, but they do the hard work of actually running the study. It's been a large team effort, and it's slow, so there's no research that can just be knocked off in a year. This is really a decade, but it's been a very, very interesting process going through this.
It must be very satisfying to finally have it rolling out.
It's nice to see it happening.
Yeah.
It's not going to finish until 2021, but it's nice to see it happening.
Crystal balling, if the outcomes are positive, what sort of impact could this have on population health around the world?
So if we do see about a 3% absolute mortality reduction, which is what the European data suggest, that's applicable to every sick ventilator patient in intensive care. So the inclusion criteria just ask people to predict, do I expect this person will be extubated tomorrow? And if not, they get started on STD. Or, oops, I got it wrong. I thought this guy would get extubated, but things aren't quite going right. Let's start the STD now as well. So it's trying to provide this treatment to every ventilated patient who's going to be ventilated for more than 2 days or so. There's a pretty large number of those worldwide. And if we can save them from hospital-acquired infections and save lives, then that's going to be a massive public health benefit.
And presumably there's also an economic benefit in terms of those who not necessarily have a mortality benefit but have a reduction in complications and length of ventilation and so on.
So time on ventilator, development of ventilator-associated pneumonia and other nosocomial infections.
So an enormously important question to answer. Ian, thanks very much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on the podcast today. For more great episodes just like this, visit our websites at osler.force.com.